Good afternoon. My name is George, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Regional Advisory Committee update on the New York State Health Benefit Exchange conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. Simply press star and the number one if you wish to ask a question at that time. If you wish to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Donna Frescator, Executive Director, you may now begin your conference.
Thank you, George, and good afternoon to our Regional Advisory Committee members and other guests. We've had a really good turnout today, and we're very pleased to have nearly 300 people participating in this webinar. This is one of a continuing series of outreach that we want to do to our Regional Advisory Committee. We are hoping again today to get your advice and input on a number of our planning activities. So I'm going to turn this over first to Danielle Hollihan, who is Deputy Director of the New York Health Benefit Exchange, and she's going to give us some general updates on activities since we last met. And then we're going to ask Randy Imbriaco, who's Director of Plan Management for the New York Health Benefit Exchange, to walk us through a series of slides about the invitation for qualified health plans and standalone dental plans to participate in the exchange. And then we're going to ask Sarah Rothstein, who's Assistant Director of Policy for the exchange, to walk us through a set of slides for our Navigator and In-Person Assister program. You are on mute. We will take questions after the presentation. George will assist us, and he will have you in queue to ask questions at the end of the presentation. Danielle, please go ahead.
Great, thank you. So we just wanted to give a few updates on some recent developments since we last met. First, we're happy to say that in mid-December, HHS granted us conditional certification to operate a state-based exchange. This is in recognition of the progress that we've made and demonstrated readiness. This is an ongoing process, though, so it's conditional certification as the states that were no state was certified. No state is ready to open their doors today. So we're conditionally certified, and we will continue the blueprint process, updating documents as necessary. And just want folks to be aware that any document we've submitted for the blueprint is already on our website, and we will continue to post updates there as well. We'll make it very easy to identify. We have a log created that identifies updates to the blueprint. So update number one, conditionally certified. And then we also were happy to say we were awarded another federal grant in the amount of $186 million. This is our level two establishment grant, and this is going to fund 2 years' worth of activity for the exchange. It'll fund all of the remaining establishment activities and our first year of operations, so all activities through the end of 2014. The funding will include support or continued support for our IT system, for the call center, our outreach, marketing, and advertising campaigns, the in-person assister program, which we'll talk about later, and finally, the exchange staff. We have another couple of slides just by way of reminder. This first slide lists the policy studies that we've released to date. These are all available on our website, and we've spoken with you all about each of them. The modeling, the market merger group size, basic health plan, benefit standardization, reinsurance and risk adjustment, third-party assisters, and central health benefits. We are also about to release an additional 8 studies in the coming days and a few maybe within the next week or so. I think we've told you that we're working on these, and we're happy to say they're all either done or about to be completed. These include work on looking at issues around insurance markets, the Medicaid benchmark benefits analysis, looking at the continuation of a few state health programs, specifically Healthy New York and the Family Health Plus employer buy-in, health savings accounts, 2 studies related to SHOP, one with KPMG, which was presented at our last Regional Advisory Committee meeting, and then a second SHOP-related study with Wakely that documents a series of interviews with employers either offering or not offering coverage today. We have also asked the Urban Institute to conduct or to take the simulation modeling that we presented to you all at the state level and look at it at a sub-state level. So we'll be releasing that in the coming days. And then finally, Worked with the Center for Popular Democracy on a study of about health disparities and a number of recommendations there. So we'll be posting all those on the website, and we'll make sure that you all are aware when they've been released. We now want to turn to talking about the plan invitation, and I'll just make a couple of comments and then hand it over to Randy. We wanted to, just by way of reminder, talk to you about some issues that we're, sorry, we're having a little trouble with the slides, but I'm on slide 7 for those of you who have this slide deck. We presented on a number of topics when we were in the regions in September, and when we talked about the issue around the qualified health plans, the issues that we raised and the questions that we posed to you were, should New York impose additional state-specific criteria on QHPs, and if so, what should they be? And what we heard from you all was that it was important that we had both standard and non-standard plan options. This gets at, you know, an issue we talked quite a bit about around, you know, how much choice is appropriate. Is there too much choice in the market? So I've definitely heard that some standardization was desirable, but also heard about the need for plan innovation. And so you all, you know, we definitely heard from you that it was important to have both. Again, on this, continued on this topic, was the importance of balancing manageable number of plan options with this desire for plan innovation. So have both, but make it manageable. We think we struck the right balance, and you'll hear how we landed on that. We also heard from you about the importance of data collection on issues around health disparities and health quality. So we'll talk to you about that as well. And then finally, there was definite support for an out-of-network benefit. So that's what we talked about in September. Moving to the next slide, we talk about what are our goals of this health plan certification process. First goal is that we offer comprehensive, affordable coverage in all areas of the state. The second, that we balance plan innovation with reasonable choice. Third, that we make it easy for consumers to compare their plan options. Fourth, that we ensure that health plans have adequate networks. Fifth, monitor health plan quality, utilization of services, and consumer satisfaction. Next, that we preserve consumer protections as defined in the federal and state law and regulation. And then finally, it's important that we ensure consistency with the outside market. So with those goals as set up, I want to turn it over to Randy to walk you through the specifics of the plan invitation. Thanks.
Good afternoon. Plan management will be responsible for effectuating the certification process, so we'll go through the highlights of what the invitation will look like and what the process will be. The invitation will, the insurer requirements are as follows. The invitation will be open to all licensed and certified insurers in the state in good standing and those that meet state solvency requirements. The insurer can choose to participate in either market, the individual exchange or the shop exchange, or both. The insurer has to agree to participate in its entire approved service area unless it's granted an exception by the exchange. When you go to the next page, we start to talk about the products that have to be offered in the exchange. We're going to require standard products. Every applicant will have to have one standard product at each meta level in each county of their service area, and that standard product has to include all the essential health benefits in that plan. And then in addition to that, there will be a standard child-only offering that will be that will look and have the same essential health benefits and cost share as the standard product. It will just be priced differently for the child-only product. As required under federal law, there's a catastrophic product that will also be required, that the plans will also be required to issue and offer. We're looking, because catastrophic is somewhat of a new product, we are looking at the possibility that if there's more than one catastrophic product offered in a county, that the Department of Health may allow the insurers the option of not offering this product if there's already enough adequate coverage in that particular county. The same is with the pediatric dental benefits. The pediatric dental benefits are going to be priced separately. And the reason for that is that the federal government says that a standalone product, pediatric product, could satisfy the essential health benefits. So what we're doing is we're asking the insurers to price that benefit separately, and if there's a standalone product that's available in that county, that insurer can defer and may elect not to offer that pediatric dental and leave it to the standalone dental carrier to offer that pediatric product. All the standard products have to include the essential health benefits. However, insurers are going to be allowed to substitute in certain spots. The next slide is an illustration of the standard plans designs. These are still in draft form, so what you see here may be modified somewhat, but it gives you an idea that you'll see that in all the different metal levels, there's a specific cost share associated with each type of service, and that so each health plan that offers the standard product will have to have the cost share in each category outlined here. Okay, so I'll go into details there. Okay, next slide. In addition to foster some innovation, the insurers will be able to offer what's called a non-standard product. The non-standard products, the issuer is going to be able to elect up to two non-standard products per metal level in each county of the service area. The non-standard product means that they can add benefits that are above the essential health benefits. They can have a varying provider network. And then they can have variations on the standard cost sharing as long as they're still meeting the AV meta levels. The issuers also may elect to offer non-standard products in a part of their service area, in a sub-geographic part of their service area. The out-of-network benefits, here we were trying to achieve parity inside and outside the exchange. So the out-of-network benefits will be required to ensure that consumers have the same choices in the exchange as they do outside the exchange. So our requirement will be that if an insurer offers an out-of-network product outside the exchange in a particular county, then that insurer will also be required to offer an out-of-network product inside the exchange in that same county. This is going to be the standard for both individual market and the shop market, and the out-of-network product that will have to be offered will have to be at the silver and platinum levels. For standalone dental carriers, they will also have to go through the certification process. Standalone dental carriers, they're going to have to offer one pediatric dental product in each county of its service area. That pediatric dental benefit must match the essential health benefits, which we chose the CHIP pediatric dental benefit. Per the federal requirement, there's going to be the option of offering a high or a low level of coverage. The high is 85%, low level right now is 75%. The standalone carriers will pick one of those, and we'll call that the standard product for the dental carriers. In addition to that, the dental carriers can offer up to two non-standard products, and what we're labeling as non-standard products are adult dental, family dental, or if they choose to have a second pediatric standalone product. Every product that comes through the exchange will have to have a network adequacy test. The requirements will mirror those used today by the Department of Health and their managed care products and their HMO products. For essential community providers, we're looking for the insurers to use their best efforts to contract with all the essential community providers that are listed and defined in the federal law. And at minimum, they have to have a federally qualified health center and one tribal operated health clinic to the extent that one's available in each county. All the plans must submit on a quarterly basis. Over time, we're going to increase that to a monthly basis. And then we're going to use that information once approved. That network information will be available to consumers during the selection process on the exchange web portal. In addition, we're going to have quality and enrollee satisfaction requirements. All the insurers must develop and maintain a quality strategy for patient safety, wellness, prevention of readmissions, to improve health outcomes, to address health disparities, and to address behavioral health needs. They will have to participate in the Department of Health quality assurance reporting requirements, and they'll have to conduct consumer surveys of their members. The administrative requirements, they have to adhere to the federally required open enrollment periods. The insurers have to accept electronic enrollment transactions from the exchange. They have to maintain relationships with brokers and agents that are approved by the exchange. They have to cooperate with in-person assisters and navigators. They have to operate a member services function, comply with accessibility requirements that are required under the ADA. They have to have capabilities to have multilingual written and verbal materials and any other kind of alternative mechanisms for communicating. They also will have to maintain treatment cost calculators per the federal requirement, and that is for both in-network services and out-of-network services. In addition, there are certain marketing standards that they'll have to comply with. There's a number of reporting requirements. A lot of them come from the federal law. It's information systems requirements. The insurer will be required to have an information system to collect, analyze, and report data. The data that we'll be requiring is inclusive of the federal requirement and also includes encounter data and certain financial reporting. So this is the schedule. Our schedule is to release the invitation late January, which is coming up soon. We're going to have a question and answer period in which the everyone can submit questions and we'll receive answers by a certain time about the invitation. We'll have a letter of interest, which is a non-binding letter. It's something similar to a notice of intent where we'll give some information about interest in joining and participating in the exchange. Application submissions will be due about April 5th. Provider network submissions will have to be around April 12th. And then we're looking to have rates and forms submitted to the Department of Financial Services around April 15th. The timelines may change a little bit depending on when we actually get the invitation out. And then the plans, we anticipate that the plans will be certified by July 12th, and the plans will have to sign an agreement with the Department of Health to ensure the participation in the exchange. We'll develop educational materials for brokers, navigators, and develop the call center. We expect that plans will be ready for posting to the website around September 2013, and then we'll go live and open the doors on October 1, 2013. I will turn it over to Sarah Rossi, who will go over the in-person assistant navigator.
Thank you, Randy. So I'd like to start by describing the in-person assistant and navigator program. The ACA requires exchanges to operate this program and to provide the following functions through the program. The first is to maintain expertise in eligibility, enrollment, and program specifications, to provide information and services in a fair, accurate, and impartial manner, to facilitate selection of a qualified health plan in the exchange or, when appropriate, a public insurance plan, to provide appropriate referrals for any enrollee with a grievance, complaint, or question regarding their health plan coverage or a determination under such plan or coverage, to provide information in a manner that is culturally and linguistically appropriate to the needs of the population of New York State, including individuals with limited English proficiency, and ensure accessibility and usability of in-person assistor and navigator tools and functions for individuals with disabilities in accordance with the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. In-person assistors and navigators must also not have a conflict of interest while serving in such capacity. There are some federal eligibility criteria which we will follow. At a minimum, the exchange must select at least one community and consumer-focused nonprofit and one other type of organization to serve as an in-person assistor or navigator. These entities include trade, industry, and professional associations, commercial fishing industry, ranching, and farming organizations, chambers of commerce, unions, resource partners of the Small Business Administration, licensed agents and brokers that do not receive consideration from insurers for enrolling individuals, small businesses, or small business employees in health plans or supplementary plans, and other public or private entities that meet the requirements of the RFA, including but not limited to Indian tribes, tribal organizations, urban Indian organizations, and state or local human service agencies. As I mentioned, entities with conflicts of interest are ineligible to serve, and these entities include health insurers and their subsidiaries, associations that include members of or lobbies on behalf of the insurance industry, and other entities that receive direct or indirect consideration from health insurers in connection with enrollment in a qualified health plan or non-qualified health plan. In the September 2012 Regional Advisory Committee meeting, we discussed how New York can best design the in-person assistor and navigator program to best assist consumers. We heard several comments from you about the program, including that it should build on the successes of New York's facilitated enroller and community health advocates models. It should prepare to assist a high volume of consumers initially. It should use many and multiple types of organizations. In-person assistors and navigators should be culturally competent and linguistically accessible. And in-person assistors and navigators should have appropriate training. The goals of the selection process include to ensure that all types of organizations permitted in federal rules are eligible to compete, to provide grants to a diverse group of organizations that will provide high-quality enrollment assistance in a manner that is linguistically and culturally appropriate to the populations being served, to provide one-stop consumer assistance for exchange, Medicaid, and Child Health Plus coverage, to ensure availability of assistors in all counties of the state, and to have in-person assistors and navigators ready to provide assistance at open enrollment on October 1st, 2013. Organizations that are selected to serve as in-person assistors and navigators will be required to serve individuals, small business employers, and small business employees. Entities may not opt to only serve individuals or to only serve small businesses and their employees. Entities will be required to provide services in person to residents of New York State. These RFA will not fund call centers or other forms of web assistance. Entities will be required to provide education to potential enrollees about the exchange, insurance affordability programs, and health plans available to them. Entities will also be required to assist with health insurance applications and provide assistance at renewal. In addition, entities must submit all applications online, except in rare circumstances. In-person assistors and navigators will not be permitted to submit paper applications on behalf of enrollees. Entities must participate with training requirements, certification requirements, monitoring requirements. They will be required to monitor the productivity of individual in-person assistors and navigators, as well as to follow appeal and complaint processes and to maintain confidentiality, privacy, and security requirements. The timeline to move forward is that we'll release the RFA sometime in February. Non-binding letters of interest will be due in March. Applications will be due in April. We will select applicants and sign contracts with those entities in spring or summer of 2013. Training will commence for the selected entities in August or September of 2013, and open enrollment begins on October 1st, 2013.
Thank you, Sarah. This is Sherry Tomosky from the Health Exchange. We recognize that there was a lot of information contained in this presentation today, and we have left a generous amount of time for a question and answer period on purpose, because we know that there will probably be a lot of questions from all of you. And to help facilitate that process, I just want to make sure that you know that the slide deck that you just saw is posted to our website. The web address is at the bottom of your screen, www.healthbenefitexchange.ny.gov. I apologize, I probably should have told you that at the outset of the call, but the slide deck is posted to our website. You can access it, you know, from your computer at any point if you would like to go back and refer to a slide in order to help develop your question for us. We would also like to ask that for those of you asking questions, if our operator did not, you know, adequately introduce you with your name and your organization, if you could just preface your call with your name and organization, that will help us respond to your question. And finally, we would like to ask those on the Regional Advisory Committee to ask their questions at this point.
And those of you that are not on the committee, we will get to those questions as soon as we are able to address our committee members' questions. And so if it's possible, we would just like to perhaps order the questions in that way. And with that, George, I think we are ready to begin taking questions from our participants.
All right, your first question comes from the line of Kathleen Fish from MDP Healthcare. Your line is open. Ms. Fish, your line is open. Perhaps you are muted.
I'm sorry, we are unable to hear her, George.
Yes. Kathleen Fish, your line is open.
Oh, yes. Can you hear me?
There we go.
Yes, we can, Kathleen. Hello.
Okay. So my question for you, I would like some clarification around the statement that was made that carriers can offer the non-standard plan designs in limited service areas. Can you just clarify for me, are you referring to limited service areas, meaning in only one or two or some subset of the number of regions, or are you saying that within a region we can offer a product within a subset of the region? So if a region contains 10 counties, we would have the ability to only make that sale available in 5 of the 10 counties.
So if you have a particular service area that you serve, you have the opportunity to limit the non-standard products to particular counties within those service areas you serve, that region that you serve.
Right. So presumably, you know, I work for MVP. We're in all of the regions, so we have a blueprint across the entire state. And however the state is defining, say, the Albany region, it's made up of a number of counties. Are you suggesting that MVP can file a product that would only be available for sale in half of the counties that make up the Albany rate region?
Yes. We're going to look at, yes, you can only, it's specific to the counties. Yes. That's what you can do.
Okay.
Your next question comes from the line of Bud Clark. Your line is open.
Yes. Can you just please repeat how I can get the slides that are available that you looked through so quickly?
The slides are posted on the website, which is www.healthbenefitexchange.ny.gov. That web address should be appearing at the bottom of your screen right now as a footer on the
healthbenefitsexchange.gov.
.ny.gov.
Second question. When you're talking about the IPA navigators, you know, those folks like there?
Yes.
Are they basically folks that are going to be, you know, quote unquote, brokers, in a sense, assisting groups and individuals, because you don't have a choice to carve them out. You have to do them both. You know, if you want to do it, you got to do both. I currently own a brokerage firm, so I'm trying to see where that fits into this whole thing. That's the end of the story.
Okay, fair enough. So, hi, thanks for the question. This is Donna Frescatore. It's a question that we've gotten, I think, you know, fairly often. So what Sarah described today is the Navigator and In-Person Assister Program. Federal law requires an exchange to have contracts, a grant program for navigators. And Sarah went over the list of the types of organizations that can be navigators. They will be funded by grants from the Department of Health to provide in-person assistance to individuals and small businesses. In addition, as we have filed in our blueprint to the federal government, licensed brokers, agents, and chambers of commerce will also be able to distribute both individual exchange policies and policies for small groups on the exchange. And so we would refer you for additional detail, and we can get the link around to our website, the same website Sherry gave you, www.healthbenefitexchange.ny.gov. And in that, you'll find the blueprint document, and I believe it's Chapter 6. Anyone else want to correct me here? Chapter 6, it describes the role of brokers.
2.8.
There you go. Close to 6. So it's,
sorry, I didn't hear that last part.
0.8.
All right, so basically, if a brokerage firm has groups that go all the way from the sole prop to the 50 level to participate in these exchanges, he needs to go to that particular website, see what the requirements are, meet the time frames. I believe that they have to suggest a letter of intent by sometime in March. That slide is the one I'm really interested in. And then fulfill some sort of, I guess, continuing education, so to speak, to make sure they're qualified. But obviously, if you're a licensed broker, I would think you'd be qualified to participate in this process. Did I summarize that correctly?
Well, one little variation here. The timeline that Sarah showed you was for organizations that are interested in being navigators. If you are a licensed broker in New York State, you're licensed by the Department of Financial Services, and you complete a training course specific to offering products in the exchange, there will be a separate process by which you can have an agreement with the exchange, subject to your current relationships with a health plan, to be able to distribute both the individual and small exchange products. We'll have some additional...
I think we're both saying the same thing.
I think it's close. You would not, though, apply for the Navigator program if you wanted to work as a broker and be commissioned by the health plan. So we'll have soon additional guidance for brokers. Joe Muldoon, who is working with us on the exchange, is working on a timeline for that process, as well as the requirements for a training and certification process. So more to come shortly.
Right, because that's obviously the, that's the question on a lot of brokers' minds right now.
Okay.
Okay.
Your next question comes from the line of Kate Rose from Monteverde Medical Center. Your line is open.
Hi there. Thanks. Kate Rose from Montefiore. Maybe two quick questions. The first one, you laid out some pretty specific dates on plan certification. How firm are those dates? Are those definitely the dates at this point that the department intends to move forward with? Is there any possibility that any of those may be moved up?
They're pretty firm. They may shift a day or two here and there, but they're pretty close to firm.
Okay, fantastic. And then in terms of kind of the strategy of the state with respect to the role of navigators versus brokers versus, places that are going to need more than just navigators, but brokers don't traditionally go there, is the state doing any sort of work as part of their kind of shop evaluation to understand where areas need to be targeted with additional assistance for individuals or small businesses where brokers would be useful, but they just don't traditionally, operate there? I'm thinking particularly in the individual market because they don't seem to operate as much there in New York, but it could be in the small group market if they just don't operate in certain areas as much as they do in others. Is that part of some of the more refined analysis you all are looking at?
No, I think we envision a statewide network of navigators and in-person assisters and also statewide availability of brokers assistance for individuals and the shop exchange.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of John Coppola from New York Association. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. I have two questions. One is, one of the slides spoke about substitution of benefits for prevention, wellness, and chronic disease management, and I think also for habilitation and rehabilitation. Could you just maybe just describe what that's all about, what an insurance provider might I'm not asking for a specific benefit, but how will that work? And I'm assuming that there's some assurance that any substitutions would maintain some base benefit of services. Maybe just talk about that a little bit, the whole idea of substituting benefits.
Well, substituting benefits is going to be narrow to certain categories of services. So your preventative and wellness, what we envision there is we're allowing the insurers to be a little innovative there with the preventive and wellness. So we don't, there's a lot of wellness programs and there's a lot of movement for prevention programs. And we're more thinking of healthy preventions of, gym membership and wellness. And so we see what we have in the essential health benefits more of a platform. We envision that what's going to happen is not necessarily substitutions there, but more so additions.
Okay.
In the prevention and wellness. And in the rehab and rehabilitative, the essential health benefits provides the floor by which they have to provide. I can't imagine there's going to be many substitutions there. There could be a lot of additions again. And there could be, the visit limits and all the visit limits that are in there are the bottom, the base level in terms of visit limits. And then if there's anything in there, it's a state mandate, like the chiropractor mandate, that's considered rehab, then that has to stay. That can't be switched out. So that's what we anticipate. I mean, so we all the other categories of services, we didn't really think that there was going to be much in the way of need for substitution. We see more probably additions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. And just one other question. This relates to the in-person assisters, and it's sort of like two I think some relatively simple questions. One relates to the certification of the personal assisters and navigators. If you have in mind an existing certification, or whether there's going to be some kind of an RFP related to doing one specific for New York, and that's really the question about how they're going to be certified.
We're developing the certification process and would be happy to share information about that with the entities at a later time.
Okay.
Your next question comes from Yoko Asahi. Your line is open.
Hi. I think earlier questions sort of answer my questions, but we are also a broker based in New York. And my question is, you mentioned that soon there will be more information about training or certificate registration for us to participate in exchange. But if you issue those report or more information, where can we find that information? Should we just go visit your website or? Are you going to post that information?
We'll make that information available on our website.
Okay. My last question is, could you clarify what are the differences between navigators versus brokers' role?
Sure. It's a good question. So brokers can opt to continue their traditional role where they enroll people in insurance products and receive commissions, or they can opt to serve as navigators, in which case they may not receive any direct or indirect consideration or compensation from insurers for enrolling people in products. So instead of receiving the commissions, they would have to opt to stop receiving those commissions and instead receive a grant from the state.
And then if we remain brokers, like traditional role, then we'll receive commission from the carriers, like as it is today?
Yes.
Correct. Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Eric Zuckerman. Your line is open.
Hi. My question has to do, again, with you just answered a question, and it seemed like it was not the answer that everyone can understand, meaning if you're a broker, you cannot be a navigator as well, correct? You can't be both. You could either be a broker and still receive commissions, or you go the route of getting a grant and then you become a navigator. But my question is, once you enroll these people the first time, there's no kind of additional grant, correct, like next year, to keep you in business as a broker. Am I incorrect on that or what?
The rule, these are federal rules. We should have said that at the outset. The federal law has this prohibition around brokers. You know, you have basically it's make a choice. If you, you know, you can receive consideration from a plan in your traditional role, or you can choose to be a navigator and receive a grant. So those are federal rules. We're just carrying out the federal rules. But the Navigator program, it's a grant-based program. We envision and we're required to have this program. It'll be an annual thing. So it will be
an annual thing. Okay,
yeah.
I understand. Okay, thank you.
No real funding. Let me just add it, Donna. The processes and systems in place for broker commissions currently will stay in place. So that I think under the current rules, you would not be compensated just once for the initial enrollment of an individual in a health plan with which you have an agreement, but that compensation would continue. And we are not doing anything through the exchange that changes the broker compensation rules that are in place right now. But you're absolutely right. As a broker, you will need to make a choice between continuing to act in your traditional role as a broker and receiving commissions from your health plan, or serving as a navigator and receiving a grant from the Department of Health for those activities. And I think that when you see that, and we will publicly release the application to become a navigator, some of the funding questions will become more clear. That will help understand the available funding for the grants, what the average size of a grant will be, and I know that one question that does come up from time to time is whether there's a limit on the number of grants, and there's not a limit in federal law. So we think that as you see more information about that program, it will help you make a choice in which direction you would like to work as a broker.
Your next question comes from the line of Matthew Wade from GFI Insurance Service. Your line is open.
Thank you. Kind of following up on the previous answers, questions, which I know you don't maybe have solid answers on right now, but I'm thinking more of the level playing field here. My understanding that in the legislation for the New York Exchange, there was some allowance made in the amount, I think, of 3% of the premium to be paid to the insurance companies for participation in exchange. Some of us in the brokerage community have read that, perhaps prematurely, to mean they're carving out a 3% to pay commissions to brokers or to use that money to fund IPA navigators. But I realize that money will be coming from a grant. My question is, where does the money come to make a grant? I know you don't know exactly how people are going to be paid, but will there be a differential in prices on the products inside the exchange, outside of the exchange, with the broker's help, without a broker's help, versus the IPA or the navigators?
No, the price for the products offered on the exchange will be the same regardless of whether a broker distributes the product or a navigator.
Okay, so there'll be, in other words, if you buy Plan A from Company B, the price will be the same. And whatever is built in there for compensation, whether it goes through a grant or through a traditional commission, would be the same.
That's correct.
Okay.
And, you know, I should mention, too, there'll be a different additional avenues for people to enroll. They may go directly to a web portal and enroll for coverage to the exchange. They may call an 800 number and work with a customer service representative. But regardless of whether they receive assistance in enrolling or who assists them, the price for the product will be the same.
Beautiful. Oh, I'd like...
Your next question comes from the line of David Sandman from the New York State Health. Your line is open.
Thank you. If you'll indulge me, a couple of questions. Two on the plan invitation. On what you showed us at slide 11, which sort of was the big table, were all of the numbers on that table just purely hypothetical about cost sharing and so on? That's the first question.
Hi, David. It's Donna. This is an illustration of different permutations of cost sharing that would meet the metal tier. So as you look down, for example, the cost sharing column under platinum, that is a combination that would, in fact, meet the actuarial value tiers for platinum. This is an illustration. I'm not certain I'd say it's hypothetical. It may not be the final standard benefit package, and that's one of the reasons we wanted to present it today in this level of detail, as though So to the extent we can get feedback from the Regional Advisory Committee or from others, that we could further refine this.
Okay, thank you. So it's a draft version, and something like this would ultimately be put out as the defined standard product?
Right. Something like this in final form would be included in the invitation to describe what the standard benefit needs to be.
Thank you. Second question was on the slide related to network adequacy. Can you just refresh us, who qualifies as a essential community provider, and is there a definition for the term best efforts?
Do you want to take the definition or want me to take the definition? The essential community providers is outlined. The definition is actually outlined in federal regulations. It includes federally qualified health centers and tribal clinics, and I think there's more specific types of providers outlined in there. And then best efforts is going to be a decision created by the Department of Health. We need to solicit from the health plans some more information on what they're doing to actually go out and network and contract with them. We'll ask for copies of contracts that they have, with the essential community providers, and kind of a strategy to outline to make sure that they're actually targeting them in their network.
Okay, thank you. And if I may, one more question on the IPA Navigator piece. I know there's been a lot of confusion about the conflict of interest piece and whether, as a result, providers would or would not be eligible to be IPAs and navigators. Could you offer a little guidance on where you're landing on that?
Sure. So the federal regulations prohibit entities who take consideration from insurers for enrolling people in plans. Those entities are prohibited from serving as navigators. If you receive compensation for other reasons, such as providing care to patients, you're not automatically eliminated, and the RFA will have additional details about the stipulations for healthcare providers.
Okay, so under certain circumstances, a provider might be eligible.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of a person who did not state their name, but they are from the Andarandak Health. Your line is open.
Thank you. This is Vicki Saraceni. I'm sorry that I did not give you my name. We have a couple of questions. One is, could you please describe the differences in the roles of patient navigation, in-person assisters, and the existing facilitated enrollment program? And what is the timeline to launch each the patient navigator and the in-person assister?
The in-person assister program will begin when the contracts for the program begin. The navigator program will begin at a date to be determined, but no later than January 1st, 2014. We expect that the in-person assister work and navigator work will closely mirror each other, and we expect that any entity that is selected as an in-person assister will make a seamless transition to serving as a navigator.
And let me, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to get some clarification, and maybe, Donna, you're going to give me some clarification regarding the existing facilitated enrollment program.
Yeah, I'm happy to. You know, we think that the facilitated enrollment program in New York, it's been overwhelmingly successful, and we like to think it's in part been a model for this navigator program that exchanges are required to have. What we've been looking at and thinking about is whether it makes sense going forward to have a set of facilitated enrollers that help people only apply for Medicaid and Child Health Plus, and yet a group of navigators that will help people regardless of the type of coverage they're actually qualified for, whether it's Medicaid, CHIP for children, or subsidized or non-subsidized cover through the exchange. So we see these two programs as dovetailing into one assister program.
Okay. Thank you. My second question is, since all of the applications will be filed online, is there going to be any mechanism for an organization to use a private portal to assist individuals in enrolling, similar to the Enroll New York portal that's currently in existence, the FIA program?
No, all in-person assisters and navigators will be required to use the Exchange portal.
People on the outside.
What about people from the outside, people who are not being helped by an assister or a patient navigator?
Any individual who is going to the Exchange and wants to enroll online will be required to use the portal. They also have other avenues of assistance, such as the call center, the in-person assisters and navigators, et cetera.
I think it's important to remember, too, that the web portal that's being built for the Exchange and will largely replace our current Medicaid eligibility system for the non-elderly, non-disabled population is being built to accommodate all of the new rules in 2014. So it will have embedded in it all of the business rules for Medicaid eligibility and CHIP eligibility and exchange subsidies, and it will interface with a federal hub to validate information such as income, such as Social Security Administration, largely eliminating the requirement for paper documentation that we have today. And so from our vantage point, it's very important to ensure that anyone that's either applying for coverage directly or is assisting someone applying is using that one central web portal to enter information. Navigators, just as brokers will be training, our navigator and in-person assisters will have to complete a training program, and they'll be our current thing is they'll be assigned an identifier so that when they enter the system to assist a consumer, they enter the web portal, we'll be able to identify that navigator as the as the assister of record, if you will, for that person.
Thank you. That was very helpful. Just one small last question on slide 14. It was a percentage, and then it had the words AV after it. Could you just tell me what the AV stands for?
Sure. The AV is actuarial value. It's
okay.
A terminology. Yeah.
Our apologies.
Sorry.
Okay. That's okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Kathleen Schur from New York, Greater New York Hospitals. The line is open.
Hi, just a couple of quick questions for clarification. Will there be any mandatory requirements for insurers to participate in the Exchange?
No.
So I thought I saw in the Article 7 that HMOs will be required to offer products, but they can do it optionally in the Exchange, outside the Exchange, or both. That's correct?
Yeah, Kathy, this is Troy Oshner from the Department of Financial Services.
Right.
Yeah, that piece in the Article 7 has to do with sort of the general requirement on insurers. It's not related to – there's no requirement that the plans participate in the Exchange, but by participating in the Exchange, they can satisfy statutory requirements.
Okay, got it. And then the second question is in terms of network adequacy – I understand that DOH will be reviewing networks, or you'll be reviewing networks in accordance with DOH standards, but will there be any requirement that if an insurer does not have a provider in-network to provide a needed service, that they be required to cover it on an out-of-network basis?
Kathy, it's Troy again. That's not something that's specifically required for enrollment in the Exchange. It's not going to be in the invitation, but it is something we're still pursuing and, as you know, in active discussions on.
Okay, thanks.
Your next question comes from a line. A person didn't leave their name, but they're from Swiss Montefiore Medical. Your line is open.
I wish it was Swiss Montefiore. My name is Drew Swiss, and I'm from Montefiore Medical Center. And my question is do you have a sense of how many of the enrollees will be newly insured versus patients with existing insurance and whether you have that information by region?
So that is going to be part of what we release in that Urban Institute report I mentioned. So statewide, we're expecting at full implementation 1.1 million enrolled across both the individual and shop exchange. The subset that were previously uninsured is around 375,000. And so the detail that we think we'll release with this invitation or maybe a little bit earlier in the next day or two is going to take the data looking at who's uninsured today and who's uninsured and where they go when health reform is implemented. And we're going to look at that across a number of different demographic characteristics at a sub-state level, at a county level where possible, and then multiple counties where, you know, sample size doesn't allow for county-level analysis. So that'll be out there. We think that's going to be really helpful information for a variety of reasons, but certainly for plans to know kind of who the new business is out there.
Then I noticed that you're studying the health spending account issue, because I noticed on slide 11 that the out of the cost sharing is very high for patients. Particularly, I'm assuming where it says outpatient facility, that's a clinic visit, where it's as much as $400, unless I'm reading this wrong.
We're going to permit health plans to offer qualified high-deductible plans that can be paired with an HSA and or an HRA in the shop market.
So the patients will have HSAs, or it's not mandatory?
It's not mandatory, but the plans will be permitted to create the products that qualify that can be paired with those high-deductible plans.
Okay. Just as a provider, it seems like this cost share is enormous. So just as an FYI, it seems very high, and especially in certain cases, at least in one case, the clinic visit out-of-pocket is higher than an emergency room out-of-pocket, or in most cases.
Just to comment on, the metal tiers are, again, outlined in federal law, the actuarial values. So, again, we're complying with federal law here with these different tiers.
Yeah, and we'll take your feedback, and we'll bring it back. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Heidi Siegfried. Your line is open.
Yeah, one thing that was sort of raised by the substitution of benefits in the two areas was I was interested in knowing, is there going to be somebody at the exchange that's going to review substitutions for discriminatory plan design?
We'll be working alongside of the Department of Financial Services to make sure the substitutions are appropriate.
Okay. And then a second question, I was really glad to see on slide 17 that plans are going to be required to comply with accessibility requirements. I wondered if there's going to be any additional detail on what they need to do, you know, like
it'll be
some
more
guidance for them, like, you know, because they really are not very good at doing this right now. Will there be monitoring and enforcement happening? Will there be somebody at the exchange that's going to do monitoring and enforcement?
It will be more outlined specifically in the invitation itself, and we're going to work in conjunction with our the other agencies for monitoring and oversight. Yes.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jay Schlenfield from Reservation Elm. Your line is Emblem. Sorry.
Thank you. I have two questions. First one concerned the network adequacy requirements. Your slide said that initially the exchange's requirements will mirror those of DOH, which kind of implies that eventually they won't. And you did talk about the more frequent reporting. Are there any other areas where you're looking to be more stringent than DOH requirements?
Well, we're going to closely adhere to the DOH managed care rules in terms of network adequacy, and we're going to require the insurers to submit on a quarterly basis their networks, all, and that's for all plans, even non-HMO networks. We're also going to have additional reporting requirements and counter data being specifically one of them.
So, Jay, it's Donna, you know, maybe just stepping back here a minute, but federal law requires exchanges to ensure that the network of all products offered on the exchange is adequate. That's a test that you well know that the Department of Health has applied for, you know, many years, maybe since the inception of HMOs, to the health, to the Article 44 lines of business. Federal law requires that we expand or extend the network adequacy test to all products on the exchange, regardless of the insurance license on which they're written. So as we looked at different alternatives, we thought that the kind of long-standing rules that DOH has had in place for Article 44s was a good starting point. We've got some years of experience of them. Nevertheless, you know, we also understand that each review is, you know, kind of on a case-by-case basis, and we need to be flexible here. But this is a starting point. We may learn over years' experience that, you know, we want to change those rules in some way. But that was really our thinking here. The other thing I would mention on the frequency of network submission is that it's just, I think, important for us to just note that a consumer who goes to the web portal to apply for insurance will see the provider network as part of the shopping experience. And so annual submissions, as DOH has been doing for commercial HMO lines of business, really just aren't frequent enough to help help consumers make informed decisions. So our goal here is to move this closer to monthly. We think that's consistent with what the federal exchange is doing. We think it's consistent with what other states are doing as well.
Okay, so that's understandable, and the discussion about the applicability of HMO rules to other products is not a new subject either, but I just wanted to kind of clarify what directions you were looking at that in, because that was kind of very ambiguous the way you had written. My other question had to do with the out-of-network products, and I think the way it's phrased, I think, because I know there have been some discussions about these being on a make-available basis. Is that still the case, or is this now is this required now?
So if the insurer has an out-of-network product outside of the exchange in a particular county, they have to have an out-of-network product available for purchase in the exchange. And it has to be offered at the silver and platinum levels. So if it's a rider, if that's what you choose to do, that's okay. You just have to make it available for purchase.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Your next question comes from the line of Sandra Jean Lewis. Your line is open.
Hi. Can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yes,
we can.
Okay. This is regarding the Navigator program. I think there is on one of the slides, it basically mentions that entities who receive direct or indirect consideration from health insurers in connection with enrollment in a QHP or non-QHP may not be Navigators. Does that mean then that a health center cannot be a Navigator? A health center who will have dealings with a QHP or non-QHP cannot be a Navigator.
Let me try to clarify. So entities that receive funds from insurers directly connected to enrolling people in insurance products are prohibited by federal regulation from serving as a Navigator. If an entity such as a healthcare provider receives funding from a health insurer for a purpose other than enrollment, such as patient care, they may be allowed to serve as a Navigator, and additional details will be released in the RFA.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Mary Ann Tomasic from Raising Women's Voice. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Mary Ann. I'm representing Lois Utley on the call. I apologize if this was mentioned already, but I was wondering how many in-person assisters or Navigators you were envisioning to have working in the exchange?
We don't have a specific number, but we're aiming to ensure that there's in-person assisters and Navigators in every county of the state.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Alice Berger from Planned Parenthood. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to actually piggyback on the question that was asked in that, I think it was you, Donna, that answered about sort of where facilitated enrollers fall in all of this. Because as you know, providers like ourselves and others who are not official facilitated enrollers but do on-site enrollment assistance at the point of actually providing health care, it's really important, and you know, I've sort of raised this before, that we have a role as this all evolves, and I was just wondering if there was additional thinking sort of on your part, and particularly in our sets of services where the confidentiality question and the time-limited and the urgent nature of our clients receiving services, that when it's linked to insurance assistance and enrollment, you know, it's tremendously effective, and we've been doing it for about 12 years. So I was wondering, you know, sort of what your thoughts were.
Thank you for your question. This is Sarah. In the regulations that HHS released on January 14th, they announced a new category of assisters. I'm going to try and get the name right. I think it's consumer application assisters. Those are entities that will be trained and certified by the state but will not be funded by the state. Those regulations are just the proposed regulations right now. We're trying to understand what HHS envisions that role to be, but when we know more about that, we'll share that information, and that sounds like a potential role of the type that you're speaking about.
Okay. All right. I mean, in other words, you're sort of tying it to really specific language of proposed regulations. In lieu of no regulations at all about this, there's nothing that actually precludes, I mean, it's the question really, sort of precludes the us's of the world, the model that we have, as doing some type of function, as I think it was Don, or maybe it was you mentioning the question of sort of concentrating on the public insurance level.
Yeah, no, Alice, it's Donna. You know, I think we value and we see a role for informal assisters, and we know the work that many organizations in the state do on the ground, whether they're funded through a grant or not for our current FE program. And so we've been talking to other states. We spoke, in fact, to Maryland yesterday to try to understand how that kind of informal assistance fits into the larger picture here. So I think what probably makes sense is for, you know, folks to have an opportunity to look at the application to become a navigator, see whether they feel they qualify, see whether they feel they're interested in going down sort of that more formal avenue. And at the same time, we'll be studying sort of the federal rules that Sarah mentioned around this. And we certainly will have more discussions with folks who might be willing or wanting to serve in that sort of more informal capacity. So you raise an excellent point, and we don't mean to sort of say here that there isn't this informal network that's not currently grant funded, isn't a broker receiving compensation from a health insurer that doesn't play an important role here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, thanks.
Your next question comes from Thomas Spreitzer from Brookside Limited. Your line is open.
Hi, it's Diversified Brokerage Limited, but thank you. First of all, I want to thank you all. This has been fabulous, and I appreciate the time you guys are putting into this. And I guess because you put so much time into this, I have several questions. I have to apologize in advance for them. One first quick one. There is a drop-dead date under the healthcare reform of 3/1/13 in regards to employers notifying their employees in regards to the availability of the exchanges. Do you foresee that staying as the current timeline, considering the fact that it seems like most states are fairly behind in their schedules in implementing the exchange? And how can we possibly have our clients notify employees of an exchange when many details don't even exist?
You know, we haven't heard anything about the federal government changing that timeline, so our assumption is that it remains firm.
Okay. Do you know offhand what we're supposed to be having our clients notify their employees of, other than the fact that an exchange exists? Because we can't really give them much details, as obviously this is being created.
Right now, there's no guidance on that.
Okay.
We haven't seen any model language or anything.
Okay. Second question, in regards to the navigators in relation to brokers, is the concept design for them to work
hand-in-hand with each other? In other words, can a navigator IPA recommend a client to a broker? Because it seems almost as if the navigators are going to be performing an enrollment function, but it doesn't seem to me that they're going to be doing any of the service work that the brokers generally do. So is it feasible for these IPA navigators to refer the client to a broker?
An individual or a small business is allowed to work with in-person assistors or navigators, whatever they best feel would meet their needs. We think that navigators will provide all appropriate services that individuals and small businesses would need to enroll. But if people are interested, they may also pursue support from a broker.
But will the navigators be permitted to recommend a broker to go to, or is that something they'll not be permitted to do?
No, you know, we don't see any prohibition on that, and I think the point you raise is a really important one, and honestly, probably a level of procedural detail we haven't quite gotten to yet, and that is, you know, how in the process, whether it's between the navigator and a broker or the call center and a broker or a navigator, how do we do handoff of in a way that we don't lose people in the process, you know, lose consumers who are uninsured and are, you know, interested in buying coverage. I think more detail, you know, to follow there on how all of the assistors fit together in a comprehensive plan.
Because if I could throw my two cents in on this, the design, selecting a plan design that best fits the client is only one aspect. Servicing the account throughout the year with all of the difficulties and problems and questions that arise throughout the year is probably more than 50% of the responsibility for representing the client. And if the navigators are going to be just helping them in the selection process and getting into the exchange, but from that point forward the service will end, the consumer is kind of left there with a big piece of the pie that still requires someone to help them out. Another question is in regards to, I've lived through community rating since 1993, and we have in our stable of products for our clients, we have the HIPICs that are available in the area, and they seem to, from a cost standpoint, be relatively ineffective and redundant to the community rating system because the community rating system is a pooled system, as you know. I'm curious as to where you see the exchanges fitting in the mix here, because if small accounts are not experience rated, they haven't been since 1993, and they're block rated in geographic areas, which seems to be the way the exchange is going to be functioning, and we see similar versions of exchanges in the HIPICs over the last dozen years or so, and they price-wise are really no improvement. What do you foresee the exchanges bringing to the table that I'd be able to show my clients and say, well, look at this great thing that we have here. It's an exchange, and it can do this, this, and this that you didn't have before.
Hi, this is Troy Oshner. I'm with the Department of Financial Services. And the rating rules, the new federal rating rules, without getting into the minutia, basically require individuals to be pooled with individuals, small groups to be pooled with small groups, large groups to be pooled with large groups. That's inside and outside of the exchange, and we're working our own, you know, community rating rules to be consistent with those federal rating rules. So my expectation is that, you know, the exchange is going to function, offer products, but that those rating rules won't have any more or less impact on plans inside the exchange as they would outside the exchange.
So then where would the value of the exchange be other than standardized designs that the feds have established guidelines for? It almost sounds like I'm going to, from a pricing standpoint, my clients may not see much of an advantage with the exchanges themselves.
Yeah, I mean, this is Donna. I mean, we think about this question a lot. Let me divide it into two parts. First, on the individual side, I mean, the modeling that's been done by the Urban Institute projects fairly significant decreases in premiums for individuals who currently have no option but to buy on our individual direct pay market today if they don't qualify for a public public health insurance program. And so based on the model, you know, that market, that individual market grows significantly from its current level to over 600,000 people when the exchange is fully implemented. You know, your question may be more related to the SHOP exchange or the Small Business Health Options Program or SHOP under the federal law. And it is you raise a question that I think we certainly have asked ourselves. I think other states are asking this as well, and that is, how do we design a SHOP that brings value to the existing marketplace? I mean, we have a very robust small group market in New York. We have lots of options out there for small employers to select from with the help of their advisors. And, you know, we see value here in a couple of areas, and it's something that very shortly we'll have some work that Wakely did for us from interviewing small businesses to ask them what could we do to bring value. And some of the things we hear certainly are around price, any opportunity here to reduce premium costs, and the modeling shows a much more modest decrease in premium costs under the small business option of about 5% or so. Options to make it administratively more easy for small employers. And one of the things that we've heard a fair amount about is a desire from small businesses to have defined contribution programs and allow employee choice of products. So a lot of that will be explored in this soon-to-be-released report from the interviews that were actually conducted with small businesses that purchased today.
Last quick question. I did get a email blast from NAHU, my trade organization, showing a whole bunch of certification programs that they were doing for various states, and I was surprised to see that New York wasn't even listed as a pending state. And I'm curious as to whether you anticipate NAHU being participant in a certification program, which I'm assuming we're going to be doing some sort of a certification program or educational program in order to represent the exchange to our clients.
Hi, this is Joe Muldoon. I just want to address that. We're right now working on the certification program, and we've gotten a lot of input from NAHU. I just received yesterday an outline that they did for Illinois. So we are reaching out to a lot of groups, and if they are continuing ed providers right now for DFS, they will certainly have access to the course when it's finally completed.
Okay. Thank you all very much. This has been really fabulous. I really appreciate all your efforts and time you put into this.
Thank you. Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Audrey Jopa from RHA office. Your line is open.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. I would like to know if products such as the Medicaid for pregnant women as well as the Family Planning Benefit Program will be included in the exchange.
Honestly, we don't have the right folks here to answer that question today on the Medicaid eligibility side. What we can tell you is that the web portal that's being built currently will determine someone's eligibility for Medicaid and allow that individual to enroll in a Medicaid managed care plan. We don't have the right folks here to speak about the specific Medicaid programs, though, that you mentioned.
Yes, and the second question I have, will the local Department of Social Services have a separate request for application, or how will that process work to become IPAs?
To become IPAs or navigators? No, we envision one request for applications that mm-hmm. allows multiple types of entities to apply through that process.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Alexander Clagg from Phoenix House. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for taking these questions. I had a follow-up question to a similar one that John Coppola asked earlier about the substitution of benefits. I heard you to say in your answer that most of those are likely to be additions as opposed to actual switches, but is there any specific guidelines or a standard against which you're going to review those requested changes?
Well, they all have to meet ultimately the actuarial values. So, I mean, that's the ultimate standard. You know, we're going to make sure that in the review, we can't definitively say what's going to be in and what's going to be out because we need the plans to – we need some flexibility to let the plans figure out what meets their consumers' needs. And so ultimately, though, the ultimate test is meeting the AV levels and making sure that it's compliant with federal requirements.
Okay.
Let's clarify too, though, that in substituting benefits, a health plan could not choose to not cover what is an essential health benefit. So, to the extent there's something either in federal law or in our benchmark plan that must be covered, a plan in substitution cannot decide, for example, not to cover prescription drug or not cover inpatient hospital or mental health services. What we really, I think, doing here through the substitution provisions, and we talked about it a lot, is giving some degree with of flexibility subject to the exchanges review and the Department of Financial Services review to health plans to allow them to tailor some portion of the benefit to meet the needs of their members. Let me tell you what often comes up here in the substitution is the benchmark plan that we selected has an allowance for gym memberships. And we got some questions about whether or not that meant every product on the exchange had to include coverage for that gym membership, or if there were other wellness types of activities that health plans thought benefited their members, could they substitute those? And so we're talking, I think it's important to sort of recognize, we're talking about a limited set of services that could be substituted subject to approval and as long as the actuarial value is still met. That helps.
So it does, but specifically, you know, essential health benefits includes substance abuse services. So could a substitution, for instance, say that a plan would not cover intensive outpatient services, but it would only cover partial hospitalization? And so the broad category is covered, but there's a particular modality that is not.
So let's see. So for instance, so when the categories are broken up into 10 categories, it's the 10 essential health benefit categories. So if you look at those 10 categories, there's only two in which we're going to allow substitutions. And everything else provides the base. If they want to add onto that, they can add in those other categories, but everything else has to be covered.
So the potential substitution that you described, allowing a plan to not cover outpatient substance abuse treatment, we would not permit.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. On page 15, you talked about the qualified non-standard products and that the one of those ways that they might be non-product would be that they would have a different provider network. I just wanted to clarify, that will be subject to the network adequacy requirements?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And what happens if a plan does not meet network adequacy requirements, you know, A, at the beginning of the exchange, and B, if it loses its meeting of that standard over time after it's been in operation?
At the beginning, they have to meet network adequacy in order to be certified to come into the exchange. Later, as time goes on, if they lose it, there's a recertification process that occurs, and we'll evaluate the network on a quarterly basis. But the recertification is on annual. There's going to be a decertification process, a recertification process that we'll have in place to address those when they fail to meet requirements and continually fail to meet requirements.
Okay. And then finally, how will the accuracy of the network information that the plan submit be validated?
We're going to follow the Department of Health standards, and what they do is to validate it is there's a database of providers that they currently have, and we measure their submissions against that, and then we get proof that there's actual contract between the provider and the health plan.
They do that on a sampling basis or something like that?
Yeah, mostly on a sampling basis, but if it's going to have a large impact particularly.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of Susan White from Nathan Latour Hospital. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Susan. Thank you for taking these questions for us. One question that keeps coming up in our area is people are wondering if they have employer-based coverage at the time that the exchange is open, will they be able to go into the exchange if the exchange costs and benefits are more financially feasible for them, or do they have to stay with their employer's insurance?
So I think this gets at, there are federal rules here around the tax credits. So if you have what they call affordable comprehensive coverage offered to you, so there's certain provisions around, you know, how that's defined. I think it's a 60% actuarial value and can't cost more than 9.5% of your income. If those tests are met, you have access to that type of insurance, you're not eligible to buy coverage through the exchange with a tax credit. If you're willing to pay full price, you can come in through the exchange.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Stephanie Meyer from New York Now. Health Now New York. Your line is open.
Hi, I just had a follow-up question on the out-of-network benefits. You stated that if an insurer offers an out-of-network outside the exchange, then they have to offer one on the exchange. But what is the benchmark for that? Is that the plans that are offered in 2014 or what we currently offer now off-exchange?
2014.
Okay. And then, so for instance, if we have a bronze product off the exchange, bronze that meets actuarial bronze value off the exchange, that would not qualify because it has to be at the silver and platinum level?
It would. Yeah. I mean, our test is going to be if you look at the – do you want to answer, Troy? Because I don't know. Okay. So the test is going to be if it's if there's a bronze level at a network product, there has to be a bronze level, at least a bronze level at a network product in the exchange.
No. I think the idea is if you offer – outside the exchange at any level that you have to offer inside.
Oh, sorry, you have to offer silver and platinum in the exchange.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah. And maybe we should talk a little bit on the rationale, and I can tell you as we were developing what are suggested plan participation parameters, perhaps we spent more time talking about out-of-network benefits than any other topic, and I think it's important to remember that in 2014, in order for an individual to be able to receive their federal tax credits, they need to buy through the exchange. And so we wanted throughout the state to give consumers an option to receive both their federal tax credits and choose a plan that has out-of-network benefits. And we felt that, you know, like many things here, that we needed to strike a balance. And we think that this approach says that if there's an offering outside the exchange, that we think it's only fair to have a consumer have an opportunity to buy that product as an out-of-network benefit on the exchange as well. I can tell you that, you know, we talked about whether or not that product should be offered at all metal levels, and our suggestion here is a requirement at two of the levels, and we can share a little bit of that rationale. Remember that it's the silver level, where individual consumers at or below 250% of federal poverty level can get help with their cost-sharing credits.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at the chart that was an illustration of the standard benefit on page 11 of your PowerPoint, you'll see that within the silver tier, there's multiple variations of cost-sharing based on different income levels. So that was the rationale for silver. It was also, I think, pointed out to us along the way that there are some individuals who have health care needs, and that it would making the out-of-network benefit available at the platinum level would sort of ease the transition for the benefits as well.
So just to clarify, regardless of what product is offered off the exchange in terms of actuarial value, out-of-network, off-exchange, regardless if it's bronze, silver, or gold, what has to be offered on the exchange with an out-of-network benefit would be silver and platinum.
Correct.
Is that correct? Okay.
Correct.
And I just had one other question. I'm sorry. So the certified application counselors that are referred to in the guidance that was released on January 14th, how does that differ from the in-person assisters and the navigator programs that New York State is going to be running?
I think there's two parts to that answer. The first is that the regs that came out on January 14th are proposed regs, and so we're still working with HHS to understand what the intent is behind those. But I think the bigger difference is that the certified application assisters, per federal guidance, will not be funded by the exchange, whereas the in-person assisters and navigators will be funded by the exchange through grants.
Okay. And I lied. I have one more question just to verify. So I know the Oxford Benchmark Plan has the hearing aid benefit as a rider. It was filed as a rider, but is the hearing aid benefit required as an essential health benefit on all exchange products for 2014?
Yes.
Okay. And will those hearing aid dispensing providers have to meet network adequacy?
I'll look into it. I'm not sure what the requirements are there.
Okay. I'm sorry. I had way more than two questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from Jeffrey Nagel from Nagel & Associates. Your line is open.
Yeah, I had a question. I saw the standalone pediatric dental, but the way I understood it is the pediatric dental coverage was part of the essential health benefits. Are the actual health carriers going to be required to provide those services within the health plan, or are they going to be allowed to partner with standalone dental carriers? How is that all going to tie together?
So the rule is that it is part of the essential health benefits. The guidance from the federal government is that if it is offered from a standalone carrier, that'll satisfy the offering of that essential health benefit in the exchange. What we have to require is for the insurers, though, they have to come in with a pediatric dental benefit separately priced, because we won't know about any existence of standalone until it's a simultaneous submission with a standalone carrier. So the health plans are still going to be permitted to partner with offering that, you know, with the dental carriers and offering that benefit. It's just a matter of how it's going to be submitted, if it's going to be submitted with as part of the health benefit package or as a standalone. And so they're going to submit it first. Everyone's going to submit the standalone carrier simultaneous with the health insurance carriers, and then the insurance carriers, if there's enough coverage from the standalone, the health insurance carriers have the option to not offer that pediatric dental.
I guess I'm a little confused. So you're saying if there's enough standalone carriers, the medical plans will not be required to offer the dental piece?
The pediatric dental, yes.
Well, I guess I'm confused, though. If the plans are supposed to be the same inside and outside of the exchange, then if a small business buys a plan outside the exchange that doesn't have that dental benefit, have they not met the requirements that they're required? Because how are you going to force a business outside the exchange to buy the standalone dental piece?
I think outside the exchange, the rules are different, and Troy may be able to speak to that.
Well, yeah, outside the exchange, we're still developing the final rules, but, you know, it's part of essential health benefits, so it would have to be made available. And how we precisely do that, you know, in other words, will carriers, insurers be able to partner up with standalone entities is something, you know, we still haven't settled on, but I think that's actively being discussed that we would be doing something similar outside the market.
And just to follow up, I think one part of your question was, how are we going to make people buy it? We don't have to make people buy it. We have to make it available, and then it's their choice whether or not to take that piece.
Okay. I guess there's just a lot of rules conflicting at this point in terms of, you know, the things have to be the same on and off, but it has to be part of the essential health benefit. And how are all those things going to mesh together? It sounds like those things are still to be resolved.
Well, not really. This is, again, Troy Oshner with the Department of Financial Services. It's part of the essential health benefits. It has to be offered inside and outside of the exchange. So really what we're just talking about is how we're going to effectuate that.
Okay.
Your next question comes from the line of Victor Bell from Metro Plus Health. Your line is open.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking the call.
I just had two brief questions. My first question comes from page 11 with the standard plan designs. Earlier in the month, I received a draft of the standard plan designs. I know this one is still in draft form, of which for the silver metal level where you have the CSR versions, there were actually AV values built in underneath each version, and on this one I didn't see them. So I was just curious if that was still the direction you were going with the metal levels.
Yeah, in the invitation, it'll have the AV levels included.
Okay. My second question comes from the navigators. I was wondering, once you have the contract signed with the navigators, is there going to be, and I apologize if you already answered it, is there going to be a listing available of who the navigators are in all of the counties?
Yes, that list will be made available in many places, including the Exchange web portal.
Okay. And then the other part of the question was, will we be privy to, I guess, not the training materials, but just the logistics on how each navigator or the navigators are going to be trained in regards to helping the enrollees with their selection process? Like, for example, will a navigator have the ability to, I guess, give insight to a particular enrollee if they have a diabetic, you know, need and there's an enrollment plan that has a great diabetic case management program? Will they be given suggestions on that, or is it completely up to the enrollee to select what the health plan that they want to select?
The federal rules require in-person assisters and navigators to be impartial regarding the selection of an insurance plan. If a enrollee comes to a navigator and says, I want to make sure that my physician is in the insurance product that I select, can you help me find out if my physicians are in a particular insurance product, the navigator can help with that.
The quality measures for health plans would also be available. I mean, that's information that we, as we currently do today, to new Medicaid managed care enrollees, we would make that information available at point of plan selection.
Okay, perfect. And my final question, thank you, goes back to the metal levels and the AV values. So under the silver product at the 70% AV value, how is it broken out, or the logistics for the individual AV values in between each FPL? Do you understand? From the previous grid that I came across, for example, you would have the silver tier, then you would have for the 200 to 250% FPL, you would have an AV of 70 to 74%, and then it rises as it goes through each CSR version, and I was wondering, what were the logistics behind that?
Do you want to answer that? I mean, that was a lot of work involved with the Department of Financial Services. I'll leave it to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think just for the purposes of this call, it'd probably be better if we had a separate call and we can kind of walk you through that. If you know Gary Tytel or some of the folks at the Department of Financial Services, that'd probably be a more appropriate forum to like really get into that level of detail.
Yeah, I mean, just at a more global level, and maybe we should have taken a minute here to explain slide 11 for folks who have not been nearly as immersed in this part of the discussion. And I think it relates to a question from Montefiore earlier, if you're still on the phone, about some of the cost sharing levels. As you go across the chart and you see under the silver versions, the poverty level, that is the applicant's income expressed as a percentage of federal poverty level. If you look to where it says 100 to 150%, what you'll see is that the cost-sharing credits are filling in how much the person would have to pay out of pocket for their services. So someone who's at between 100 and 150% of federal poverty level, just slightly above the new Medicaid eligibility levels at 138%, would, for example, pay $50 for a service on the outpatient facility line or $75 for an ER service, as opposed to someone whose income was higher and they selected silver. So I think the main point here is that for people in the income brackets you see under silver, there is a clear benefit for those individuals to pick a silver product on the health insurance exchange, because they get a much better benefit than even if they picked a gold or a platinum product. And that's something that we're going to need to work with our navigators and our brokers who are working in the individual market to help consumers understand that choice. So
if there's questions, and we can certainly, choice folks are way better at the actuarial detail, but in essence, that's what this chart displays.
Your next question comes from the line of Elizabeth McDade from Finger Lakes Health. Your line is open.
Hi. My question actually has to do with the grants to CBOs to ensure cultural competence. Could you speak a little bit more about that?
So the in-person assisters and navigators are required to be linguistically and culturally competent. Training for in-person assister navigators will cover a variety of topics, including that one.
Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Nathan Short from Total Capital Planning. Your line is open.
Hi, how are you all doing?
Good day.
Just had a couple questions for you. This might be really hypothetical, but the plan comparisons, or the page 11, the templates of the draft of what you think the plans are going to look like, do you have any expectations, even hypothetical, about what you're expecting those plans to come in as, like what the monthly rate would be for a plan like these?
No, I'm going to let Troy answer that one.
This is Troy again from Department of Financial Services, and so we're going to review each application from each insurer and review the rate that they propose, and after our review, approve a rate. And I think our guideline is it's got to be actuarially sound. We need to make sure that the insurer, first and foremost, is solvent so that they can pay the claims that you're paying good premiums for. I can't off the top of my head give you a number. We haven't seen any of those submissions, and so it really would be premature to even take a guess.
Sure, I understand. But so even if I was saying that to look at the Platinum plan, for example, just as a broker, I know that if a small business was looking to buy this plan, the closest they could do it would be in New York would be an Oxford plan. I know right now that rate for a plan that matches as closely is in the $700 to $750 range, depending on network. It isn't even to that point that you have an expectation of price, or?
No, not at this level,
okay.
No.
Sure, I understand. Okay, so back to the IPA and Navigator questions. I'm sorry that you probably have to keep answering these. We keep saying IPA and Navigator, but what I'm kind of confused about is these are obviously two separate roles that are very similar, but it's really two different types of job, right? It's not just an interchangeable term for one person.
We think that the programs mirror each other quite closely, and we expect that anyone who is selected to serve as an in-person assister will seamlessly make the transition to serving as a navigator. There are not substantive differences.
One thing I saw, obviously, inherent in the name in-person assistant or in-person assister is that this is somebody who's going to be able to deal face-to-face with consumers shopping for insurance. Our office, we have a couple people in our brokerage who work remotely, who don't live or necessarily work day-to-day in New York City or the area. I'm assuming from what I'm seeing here that would kind of make those people or our offices in general kind of ineligible for a navigator position, even if otherwise we would be qualified, we would be able to help in making the decisions or doing all the other roles of a navigator. Is that right?
So in-person assisters and navigators are both required to provide all services in person.
Oh, okay, so everything is going to be done in person for those jobs anyway.
Yes.
Okay, how do you envision that role? Is it when somebody is a navigator, are they going to be working on an outbound sales basis? Are they going to be soliciting businesses or individuals to try to get them to work with them to sign up for insurance, or is it more going to be structured as inbound where somebody is going to be coming to them looking for help?
I think it will be both.
You think it'll be both? Do you have any ideas about I'm trying to think about a phrase of the question. Do you have any expectation of a certain criteria that has to be met? For example, to qualify for the grants or to continue qualifying for the grants, is a navigator going to have to sign up 100 people a year or 1,000 people a year, or is it kind of just if you get qualified, you're going to get a block grant, and however much business you sign up is however much you sign up?
All of the details about that type of information will be in the RFA.
Okay, so it's not entirely cleared up yet, or?
The details will be released soon for the RFA.
Okay, for what it's worth, if it's at all up to debate, I would say that if a navigator is paid regardless of performance, it doesn't really seem to make sense versus, say, somebody like a broker, where our compensation being tied into the premium, the more business that we help sign up for a plan, the more business that we keep satisfied and that we keep as a client, it makes us incentivized to provide a better service. If somebody is getting paid the same lump amount, even if they sign up one-tenth of what our office might sign up through the portal, this doesn't really seem to make sense. But thank you all very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jeremy from EKA Brokerage. Your line is open.
My question is, how often are you going to allow the insured to make plan changes? Because my understanding is that if navigators who are not licensed and who have no experience in this kind of arena are just going to be able to pass some kind of certification to advise clients as to what benefit may work best for them, or on the opposite side, allowing consumers to enroll directly online without any kind of advisement from a trained broker, how often are you going to allow these people to make plan changes?
Well, there's open enrollment periods established under the federal regulations. So once they sign up and they're enrolled, that they have that plan for an entire year to 12 months, depending on where they're getting that. So in the individual market, it's a calendar year basis, and the only reason for switching plans would be differences in life situations. So if they become unemployed or things of that nature. So they won't be allowed to switch plans, randomly.
My second question is, we have clients in all 50 states. And we're licensed brokers in the states that we do business with. How will our licensing appointments, whether we have navigators in our office or, you know, us as brokers, how will that transpire to the out-of-New-York markets for the exchanges and so forth? If I have a client in California who possibly qualifies for the exchange, you know, regardless of what lines of business I do, and they're looking for my expert advice, will New York appointments, will anything, will we still be able to work with clients out of New York State through the exchange?
If you were to be a navigator, is that your question?
Well, really for a broker.
I'm sorry, I want to make sure that I understand the question. So you're licensed in New York as a broker by the Department of Financial Services?
That's correct.
That's correct. So in order
and I'm also, if I'm licensed in California and I have a client who is in California and wants to go into the exchange in California, as a New York agent, we'll still be allowed to be licensed and appointed in California to aid these people in enrolling in the exchange and be compensated?
Sure, I mean, there's nothing here's how I think I kind of boiled the question down. It works is that in order to sell products on the New York State Exchange, you will need to be licensed as a broker by New York State. It sounds like you already are. You will need to complete New York State-specific training. And you will need to have an agreement with the exchange to sell products on the New York State Exchange. California may have an entirely different set of rules, and that's something that you need to address with them. But our state of certification to sell products on the New York State Exchange is for New York State.
Okay. And again, I just listening to the calls, and I'm getting emailed from a lot of broker friends that I have as we talk. I think we're all in agreement that it's going to be very difficult to have navigators, and this is just my opinion, again, if I could put my two cents in, it's going to be very difficult to have these unlicensed, untrained navigators to be advising people as to which plan. I mean, initially when we started talking about healthcare exchanges and reform, it was to make it easier for the consumer to be able to choose a plan. Now we're looking at 9 different options in which, again, these navigators are going to be able to direct consumers as to what plan is best for them. But it seems like they're going to be locked into a contract for a year. It's my opinion.
I would, I, Yeah. So this is Donna. I would remind you that the federal law requires state exchanges to have grant programs for navigators, and I would encourage you to take a look at the requirements for navigators when that application comes out, because I think you'll see that, in fact, we will be looking for groups that have experience, and there are many community-based groups in New York that have signed up millions of people for our public health insurance programs, and that you also take a look at the training and certification requirements for navigators.
But similar to like what Nathan had asked previously about a brokerage firm or an office where we have customer service reps and account reps inside of our office who do a lot of work with our clients, and, you know, regardless of whether it's group insurance or on an individual level, being able to not advise them directly, but to also help them work through claim issues, billing issues, and it would seem almost feasible to allow brokerage firms to have people inside of our offices appointed as navigators, even though you're saying that there's restrictions
Not permitted. Sarah's said this before, but let me just, the federal rules do not permit a broker to receive a navigator grant. So I think it's done at the entity level. So if you work for a broker, and you're acting, your organization is acting in a capacity as a broker, receiving commissions from a health plan for selling products in New York, your firm, not your individuals, but your firm could not receive a navigator grant. Those are not our rules. They're the federal rules. They apply in all states.
Okay, so we wouldn't be able to receive a grant, but people would still be able to be like an individual enroller working in our brokerage agency.
You would be able to, you would be able act to, acting within your license as a broker, sell insurance products on both the individual and small group exchange.
And in the interest of time, we have about 10 minutes left, and we want to make sure that we've addressed as many questions as possible. So maybe we can take the next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Denise Smith from Regional Advisory. Your line is open.
Hi there. I'm representing AARP on Long Island. To piggyback on some of the other questions that are being asked on brokers versus navigators, do you envision a situation where a broker may want to go the navigator route, get the grant, but is actually deciding on the navigator route, I'll represent these insurance carriers, but I'll still stay as a broker and represent these insurance carriers. Can you envision that happening where they're working as both?
No, that would be prohibited by federal regulations.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jamie Juarez. Your line is open.
Hi, we just have a couple of rules of the road underwriting questions. Just to get clarity around the individual market that's going to, in the exchange, is going to continue on a community rated basis. Will there be any use of demographics in that?
Let Troy answer the question.
Hi, this is Troy, Department of Financial Services again. What do you mean use of demographics?
Age, sex, rated?
No. Now, you know, New York is a pure community-rated state, and that is not expected to change.
Okay.
So
and
there's still going to be – I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's fine. With the SHOP program, is it anticipated to go to 50 lives or 100 lives? I was unclear as to what the state's position on that was.
Right. We're going to keep it at 50. And
is
2016, it has to go to 100, and we can reserve the right to have it go earlier, but for now we're going to have it up to 50.
And with respect to qualifying at the 50 lives level, will the state be using the current definition of eligible employees, or will there be some?
Well, again, this is Troy again. We need to comply by 2016 with the federal definition on employees. I think the current thinking is we're going to stick with the state version until then.
Your next question comes from the line of Marjorie Cadogan. Your line is open.
Yes, I had a question that related to the IPAs and navigators' scope of work with regard to individuals who are going through renewal for coverage. Will there be something in the solicitation, or do you have a sense now of the scope of service you desire them to provide to individuals addressing renewal?
In-person assisters and navigators will be permitted to provide support for renewals.
And is there any more sense of your standard for what that assistance would be?
I think it would be the same level of assistance that's provided when people enroll for insurance.
Your next question comes from the line of Douglas Hickey from SKCG. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, just clarification. Hopefully you have the expertise on this. I want to use the word that the insurance company is using called dumping. It's just a question relating to accessibility to the coverage. Let's say a hypothetical. Let's say Bob doesn't have any coverage. He decides to take the penalty. Let's say the penalty is, you know, $100 or $300, whatever it is that particular year. He decides not to have any coverage, so he just absorbs the penalty. Monday morning he wakes up and he finds out that he has cancer. Can he simply pick up the phone and sign up for one of these programs and at the end of the day have health insurance coverage?
No. There will be specific open enrollment periods. He'll have to join up during the open enrollment period.
Oh, okay. All right. So it won't be just on a daily basis. It'll have to be similar to Medicare or Medicaid when you can just, so on a six-month basis or whatever, you can jump in.
Yeah,
So for the first year of the individual exchange, that is coverage in 2014, the open enrollment period starts on October 1st of 2013 and goes to the end of March of 2014. So that's an extended open enrollment period for the first year. In the subsequent years, that enrollment period, open enrollment period, looks more like a traditional employer enrollment period. That is different than the way our individuals' direct pay market works today. So that is a change based on federal law.
Okay, and one other question.
Yeah, another question is if we have small group clients that are based here in New York, but they have other offices, let's say in New Jersey or Connecticut, and if they're interested in getting involved in a shop exchange, how does that impact those satellite offices with employees living and working in those other states? Is it based on the location of the corporate headquarters, or are those individuals in other states not allowed to participate in a New York shop exchange?
Those participants in the other states will have to participate in the states of their residence.
So in the sense of a group that's in New York and they have an office or they have people living and working in another state, if the company decides to join a shop exchange, those employees would not be able to participate in the New York shop exchange. They would have to then join an exchange in their state.
In their state. But if they work here in New York, I think that the rules are that they have the option of joining the New York. So it depends on where they're working. So if they're working in another state and their residence is if their residence is in New York, it depends on where their residence is and it depends on where they're working. I think the rules are if they're a resident here in New York, they can get coverage through the New York exchange. If their residence is in the other state, they have to get coverage through the other states unless there's a plan that's a national plan or available.
And they would have to do that on an individual basis because the employer based in New York obviously could only contract with a New York-based shop exchange. So that employee would then have to join an individual exchange in their state of residence.
I'm gonna ask Troy to clarify.
Okay, and if I'm incorrect on this, we'll send out we'll make sure to be clear, but. My understanding is that the way it works now is the same that it will work in the exchange, in that it's where the policy is delivered. So if the small employer, and we have a little test for that, but basically if the small employer is based in New York, that if they have some employees that are, say, in Pennsylvania, that that's okay. They can still get their coverage through the New York, that policy issued by a New York insurer.
Yeah, because I would assume that would be a significant issue, especially downstate, you know, throughout Manhattan, the five boroughs, and, you know, and even like Westchester, Rockland County. You have a lot of New York-sited business, but you have a huge bedroom community, you know, of commuters coming in from Connecticut, especially north and central Jersey, where that would be a big disruption for a small business who was considering that, if those employees then would have to go and get individual or join an exchange on an individual basis back in their you know, their resident state.
Right. And, you know, I think this is a question that comes up from time to time, and I think we will want to get some guidance out on it. And I think it also speaks to the importance of, you know, carefully looking at a plan's provider network, both the in-network part of the plan and any out-of-network benefits that might be available to people who are employed by a small employer in New York but might reside either in Pennsylvania or Connecticut, as you said, or other bordering states. So we'll get some clarification on this point out.
All right. Thank you.
George, we're coming right up on 3 o'clock. We want to take one or two more questions at the most, and then for those who have questions that we didn't get to, we'll describe when we wrap up how we can address the questions that you have after today.
Perfect. Your next question comes from the line of Mary Lou Beska from Executive Design. Your line is open.
Yes, good afternoon. I know a lot of these questions have already been, you've addressed a lot of concerns of the brokers, and all right, you advised that more information would be forthcoming for the brokers, and do you have any kind of an approximate timeline for the release of this information?
Yeah, I don't think we have a specific date that we can provide you during this call, but we'll get something out shortly.
Okay. Anything that would be available would be on the website, Health Benefit Exchange?
Yeah, that's right. And
where to look for it?
Yeah, and we'll consider some other venues, too, to continue the conversations about the role of brokers.
Right.
Joe Muldoon is here today and is really our liaison with the broker community on the exchange. He's been working with the major broker associations in New York, and I think we'll ask them to help us figure out how to help get information out.
Okay. All right. So you do know that at this point we do know that the brokers will have to be licensed in the state, and of course they would have to participate in a certification program to be trained on this whole exchange process.
That's right.
Okay.
And that the brokers would be able to be certified for both,
okay,
if they choose, for both the shop and the individual exchange.
Right. Okay. And then the same plans will be offered by all the insurers, and then the rates will vary similar to the Healthy New York program?
Well, the standard product would be required for all insurers as a term of participation in the exchange. But
mm-hmm.
as Randy described earlier, we would also allow insurers at their option to offer a limited number of non-standard products where they think that, you know, that there might be additional benefits that they might want to offer over and above the essential health benefits. They may want to use a different variation of their network, or they may want to change the cost sharing from what you see in the standard plan.
Okay. All right. And then these rates, are they, once the rates are established, is that going to be annually, or are they right now the community-rated plans for small groups is quarterly?
Yeah, for the individual exchange, they will be annual calendar year rates.
Calendar year rates.
For the shop exchange, for the small business, we will follow what's currently done in New York today, and they'll be rolling quarterly rates.
For the one-year guarantee.
What is going to be quarterly? I'm sorry.
The shop rates, so the rates for small business as they currently are today, they would be established quarterly, and the rate that an employer would pay would be based on when they bought the policy, basically. That's how it works today.
Okay,
okay.
We can take our last call, George. Or, I'm sorry, our last question.
Okay, your last question comes from Jose Ramos from North Grumman Medical. Your line is open.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, sorry, this will be a quick summary because you've addressed a lot of these things already. I just want to make sure I understand. The in-person assisters are federally funded for 1 year, but the navigators are funded by the state through their exchanges. Is that correct?
Yes, that is.
Then the other question is, who is managing this program? Is it Health and Human Services or Social Services, or is it the Insurance Department managing the program, or both?
The Navigator program?
Yes, ma'am.
The IPA and Navigator contracts will be held by the Department of Health. The State Department of Health.
Then the very last question is, the training that will be provided to, I guess, the in-person assisters or navigators will be provided by the state. Do you have a syllabus of what that may entail?
That is under development, and once we have a draft, we will make that available for comment.
Will the navigators and persons assisters be at call centers, given the fact that the hundreds of thousands of applicants are going to be arriving on websites?
I'm sorry, will the in-person assisters be at a call center? Was that the question?
Yes, because it's virtually impossible to handle the load of applicants that are going to be hitting the exchanges in 2014 in person. They have to be done through a phone.
No, well, so there will be a call center that will be operated by the exchange. So individuals and small businesses could choose to call that toll-free number and be guided through the application process by a customer service rep, or they could go to the web, an individual or small business could go to the web portal and apply online with the option of going out to customer service to assist during the application process, and even with their permission, co-browse while they're applying with a customer service rep. But by definition, the navigators and in-person assisters are in person. And that means that each of the applicants for that program will need to come up with and propose to us a strategy for how they are available in their community to assist individuals and small businesses. That is very similar to the way our facilitated enrollment program works now.
I see. Thank you very much. This has been a very, very good presentation.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. For all of those who have stayed with us through this entire call, we really appreciate your time and the variety of questions that came through. For those of you that were in queue to ask a question and were not able to, the way we will handle this is that everyone who is registered for the call today will get an email notifying them of where they can find the recording and the slides from today's presentation. We will be posting that on our website soon. We will notify everyone who is registered via email, and if you did have a question that you would like to pose that was not asked, you can just simply reply to that communication, and we will definitely get to that. So with that, I would like to thank you very much for your participation today. We look forward to doing more of these types of programs in the future, and thank you again for your participation.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.